Welcome back to the Roundtable. Duke Ellington was the greatest jazz composer of the 20th century. His songs, he wrote more than 1,500 of them, have been recorded by a who's who of popular music, from Ella Fitzgerald, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett to Steely Dan. The grandson of a slave, he dropped out of high school to become one of the world's most famous musicians, a showman of incomparable suaveness, and also he was as comfortable in Carnegie Hall as he was in the nightclubs where he honed his style. Many of his compositions, like Mood Indigo and Sophisticated Lady, remain beloved standards. In the new biography, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, Terry Teachout, drama critic of the Wall Street Journal, jazz musician and author of Pops, an acclaimed biography of Louis Armstrong, reveals the many layers of this man, as unique and complex as the music he created, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Terry Teachout to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
This is a fascinating biography. It's a fascinating, obviously he's a fascinating individual. At what point in your career and given your immersion into the subject, did you know that you wanted to spend so much time and write about this life?
It was right after I finished my last book, which was a biography of Louis Armstrong, and I was trying to think what to do next. I always like to try a different subject. But suddenly it hit me, why not Ellington? It's time for a new book. There's an enormous amount of new source material, and being a former jazz musician and somebody to whom Ellington's music is very important, I thought, well, this would be a great way to spend the next 5 years of my life, and so it was.
What was your baseline knowledge going in?
Well, as I say, I played jazz professionally in Kansas City for a number of years back in the 70s and 80s. I knew a lot about Duke Ellington, but there's a lot to know about Duke Ellington, and you can't really know how much there is to know until you start the digging. So let's just say I didn't know as much as I thought I did. How about putting it that way?
And because there are some incredible stories in this book, and I'm curious as to how much you had to dig to get to the real story.
Well, I don't know that anybody's ever going to get to the real story about Duke Ellington. He was a man who wore a mask his whole life long, who kept the world at arm's length. I say somewhere in the book that he spoke not to reveal himself, but to conceal himself. That said, we know Ellington through what other people said about him, his friends, his musicians and sidemen, his collaborators, his lovers, and it's a mosaic. I mean, with every fact that you acquire, the portrait becomes clearer and clearer. And though, as I say, I don't think we can ever really get to the bottom of him, I think that my book brings us closer than we've ever been and closer than we're likely to get for some time to come.
Tell me about the word mask, of where that starts to become apparent in his life.
Pretty early on, I think, in a way, I think it starts with the failure of his marriage. Ellington, as they used to say, had to get married as a teenager, to a high school girlfriend, and then he becomes famous. And as is so often the case, these marriages are put under a tremendous strain, which was increased by the fact that when Ellington discovered the wide world of women, he plunged into it pretty enthusiastically. It was important to him because he had been a middle-class black from Washington to be respectable, to be seen as respectable, and yet he also wanted to lead the life that he wanted to lead in private, which included a great deal of philandering, enough so that, well, the dust jacket cover of my book has a photograph of Ellington that shows that he's got quite a prominent crescent-shaped scar on his left cheek, which we usually didn't see because he wore stage makeup, and that was his upstage side. But where he got that scar was in 1927 or 1928, one night he and his wife were at home in bed, and she pulls a razor on him and says, "I know what you've been doing, and I'm going to spoil those pretty looks," and she slashed his face. He was out of there. He left his clothes behind and never came back. And I think that may have been the moment when the public Ellington and the private Ellington really started to diverge, because he had a secret to keep.
And that secret was really important for him to keep.
Yes, it was very important for him. The respectability was important, but the women were important too. I mean, he didn't just sleep with a lot of women because he liked sex, although he did like it very much. He slept with them because he found women inspiring, individual women, women in the mass, the sound and smell of them. He wrote a beautiful, beautiful ballad called Warm Valley, which let's just say that's not a geographical reference. And, you know, I mean, he couldn't do without them. And yet he distrusted them, he feared them, I think at first because of what happened with his wife. And so the complexity of his relationships with women was so fraught that Mercer, his son, actually said after his death, he thought his father actually hated women.
And I assume the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, right?
Yes, I think so. I think the truest thing you can say about Ellington in women is that they fascinated him, but on some level, he was always suspicious of them.
You talk in the book about, obviously, legacy comes up and about his compositions and looking at this man as the most important jazz composer of the 20th century. When do you start to see that genius emerge?
His first important recordings date from 1926. That was when he recorded East St. Louis. Most people say Toodaloo, but he pronounced it Toadlo. It's the first Ellington composition where his characteristic style starts to come into focus. And then it begins to happen really fast. You know, within a year or two, pretty much every time he goes into the studio, something extraordinary is happening, and he's just piling up this large body of work that gets bigger and bigger until at the end of his life, by the best count we have, he left behind 1,700 compositions. So, people vary when they try to decide what was his greatest moment, what was his greatest period, his greatest composition. But it's really as early as 1926 that you begin to see why he was important in the way that he was.
You talk about this in the book, and it's fascinating to me, about his collaborations. He had many collaborators, but there was certainly help on various compositions. But that can't overshadow his genius and how good he was.
No, it's very important to get both sides of this equation right. Ellington was not a natural writer of melody. That's not an uncommon problem with composers. Beethoven wasn't. Stravinsky wasn't. Ellington's great genius was for harmony, for instrumental color, for rhythm. But in his purely instrumental compositions, they are essentially much more often than not his own unaided work. But when Ellington wrote the pop songs that were great hits and that we know him for, like Mood Indigo, like Sophisticated Lady, more often than not, the melodic material of these songs comes in part or whole from the members of the band.
And this is a very general question, but in your opinion, and certainly as a critic, what do you think made him so good?
Well, the beginning, the key of it, is that Ellington is the first jazz composer to use instrumental color in the same way that the great classical composers use it, is a powerful individuating element of his music. Now, jazz composers before Ellington just didn't do that. They didn't have that kind of instrumental palette. But Ellington, because of his great sensitivity to color and to the colors produced by the individual members of his band, now, this becomes the thing that first sets him apart from everything else. Many other elements will come into play, but it's color that is the beginning of why we think of Ellington as the unique figure that he is.
When, given you said that this book came right after the Louis Armstrong book, how did these stories connect in a way?
Well, of course, they knew each other. They made an album together. I wouldn't quite say that they were friends. I mean, they were both on the road at the same time, so they almost never saw each other. But the most important thing you can say about Armstrong and Ellington, they are the bookends of jazz in the 20th century, but they have almost nothing in common as personalities. Armstrong is a completely open, transparent personality. And he's a guy, he wasn't embarrassed by where he came from. He was from the roughest block in New Orleans. Mother was a prostitute. I mean, he was just a down-to-earth, regular guy. And everybody who knew him loved him and felt that they knew him. Ellington, very different, comes from the black middle class of Washington, you know, a guy of polished, glittering manners, knows what fork to use, and a very private man who is always looking to keep the world a little bit apart from himself. They're just, as personalities, they're not alike at all. And that's part of what made it possible for me to write about Ellington immediately after writing about Armstrong, because the contrast is so strong.
He was very much, and this goes back to an earlier point that you made, but he was very much influenced by the music around him, wasn't he?
Yes, he had what I like to call a magpie mind. He's always listening to everything. I mean, not just the members of the band, although they were the great source, but to the music he hears in movies, if he's playing in a theater, to the pit orchestra. When in his later years he's traveling by car from gig to gig, he's always got the radio on, and he takes what he hears and runs it through the Ellington machine, and what comes out at the end of the assembly line, no matter how it started off, it ends up as Ellington.
How laborious is that machine?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How laborious was the machine? In the sense of, is it? I mean, I'm sure it varies in composition, but is it quick, or is it really a labor?
It was extraordinarily quick. I mean, Ellington could and did write music in the afternoon and play it on the bandstand that night. He was also, as I talk about in detail in the book, a great procrastinator. He just didn't like to get started with things. The most spectacular example, which is Black, Brown, and Beige, his great 45-minute suite. It's his Carnegie Hall debut in 43, one of the key moments in his life as a composer. He doesn't start writing it until 6 weeks before opening night. So he liked to put things off. He worked fast. He had the ability to work fast. It wasn't a labor, but you must also remember the machine was always running. There was no day of Duke Ellington's life when he didn't write music. No matter what happened during the day, no matter what happened on the gig, you know, he was likely to be up until 3 or 4 at the piano in his hotel room or in his dressing room making more music.
What was he proud of? Did you get a sense of what he was proud of that he accomplished?
I think Ellington may have been proudest of seeing himself as a symbol of black pride and black aspiration. He was intensely racially conscious. He believed that it was his duty to achieve, to go out there, to be the great polished artist who's treated as an artist, not just as an entertainer, who plays at Carnegie Hall, who plays in London, who plays on the BBC, who succeeds in the white world. And he was very aware that his people saw him doing this, and they felt this tremendous sense of pride that one of their people was world famous. And I think, if anything, that may have been what he would have liked to carry away. I mean, other than having been the guy who wrote this music, I think that racial side of it is very important to him.
Did he have favorites? Did he have pieces that he was especially proud of and thought were better than others?
Not really. I mean, like many creative artists, he would always tell you that the piece he liked best was the one he wrote last. He was very much oriented toward the moment. He truly lived in the moment more, I think, than most creative artists. And also, because as he grew older, he became quite age-sensitive, he really didn't want people saying, oh, well, that band from 1940, that was the good one. He wanted you to think that band from 1971, that was the good one. And he was very firm about that whenever he talked about his music.
You think of the spread of time and what he saw and changes in music. It's pretty incredible.
He was active for three quarters of a century. His career extends, it frames the major part of the 20th century. And you have to remember that when you're trying to understand him, that he was born in 1899. He is not our contemporary. As contemporary as he seems, because we still listen to his music, jazz musicians still play his music, singers sing it, but he's a man of another age, another time. And part of the task of a biographer in writing a book like this is to dramatize this sense of what his world was like, the world in which he grew up, the world in which he became famous, and to show how the world changed around him as he moved through it and through time.
Terry Tejat's new book is Duke, Life of Duke Ellington, and is published by Gotham. Terry, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, it was a great pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.